Indiana Senate Republicans reveal their budget. Mike Pence and Pete Buttigieg spar over religion. That plus changes to a controversial payday lending bill and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 12, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana Senate Republicans released their budget. The $34.6 billion budget includes $775 million in new funding for schools, but only $90 million of that would go directly toward increasing teacher pay. Teacher salaries have been one of the more contentious issues during this session. Governor Eric Holcomb made increasing pay for teachers a central piece of his agenda, and the Republican budget includes some of the governor's proposals. But teachers wanted a mandate for increased wages, and the Senate budget does not include that. Does this budget adequately handle the teacher pay issue? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Leslie Weidenbinner, managing editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and host of WFYI's No Limits. I'm filling in for Brandon Smith this week. Ann Delaney, does the budget solve the teacher pay problem?
Of course it doesn't. I mean, what we're arguing about here, or what they're proposing, as opposed to what the House proposed, is whether teachers get a little bit more than a 3% raise or a little bit less than a 3% raise. They need a 15% raise. It doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. I mean, we have teachers that are starting at pays that are lower than high school graduates can make working in warehouses. And they don't have to incur student loans debt to do this. So it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't begin to solve the problem. It is an example, again, of a lack of leadership on the governor's part. I mean, he made this one of his priorities, as he made an authentic hate crime bill one of his priorities, and neither one is he delivering on. So it does not address the problem adequately.
Mike O'Brien.
So this came to you. Recall, if you think 4 months ago or 5 months ago at the beginning of the legislative process, the governor committed at that point when this all kind of came to a head, this teacher pay issue nationally kind of came to a head, and there was more attention on it locally than or in the state than ever had been before. He said this is going to be a long term, but we're going to have to address this over the long term. In the near term, we have a budget before us. We're going to work and find any tool we can to increase teacher pay short of the one thing that does put the legislature in the crosshairs on teacher pay, which is taking over the decision of how teachers are paid. Absent that, their option was increase K-12 education to the highest levels we've ever increased it, do the $150 million to the pension to try to drive more dollars onto their paycheck. There's a provision in the Senate Republican budget that requires local school boards and school corporations to have a public meeting to talk about how they're going to use those saved dollars so they can't just take them and go spend them on something else when the legislature has directly said this has to go to teacher pay. So they've tried to do what they can within the construct of how we fund education in Indiana, which is we give it to school corporations and school boards to make decisions on how they're going to spend that money. Now, short of this legislature coming back at some point and saying, teacher pay is controlled by the state legislature or the Department of Education, that's as good as you can do.
No, you can put more money in it and let the school boards. They're not throwing money away. They're paying the light bill and the health bills with this.
No,
okay?
I understand that, but there's always money for the artificial field at the football field.
But
you know, I think people look at that.
Even if you gave 15%, a 15% increase to schools, that's under the current system, there's no guarantee of how much they would give to teachers. They could still give none of that money to teachers if they wanted to. So it is a discussion about a fundamental change in the way we think about education.
That would require a fundamental change. You're exactly right. Now, there is a push, though, and it may be in the bill, I think, at this point, that would require public hearings, at least as it relates to the money that would be freed up by the penalty liability issue.
Right.
The pension liability issue, whereby school boards would ostensibly invite the public in and say, yes, we know that teachers are underpaid and we want to do that, but we have a need to pay the light bill.
Okay,
or
okay,
there,
okay, but, okay, well, but even me, if you me, did that, even if you did that with $150 million, you're talking about $1,000 a year per teacher. Okay, that doesn't get a $30,000 a year teacher to where she needs to be at 40-something thousand a year.
John Schwanis, I'm going to ask, because it sounds like there's an awful lot of effort that's been thrown at solving this problem, and the sides are still pretty far apart. Is it possible to bridge this gap, or do we have a situation where there have to be winners and losers?
I don't think it can be bridged to everyone's satisfaction this session, which probably means, because it's a budget session, it won't get bridged next year either, but perhaps this is a continuation of a discussion, as Mike suggested, that the governor says will maybe result in sort of the panacea at some point. Now, you talk about the effort that's gone into this. I do think this may be, reminds me of what teachers used to say in grade school and high school, show your work on those math problems, because you may get partial credit for the effort if you just screwed up somewhere along the way, but you kind of had the right concept. That's why I think we're not.
Does that happen to you a lot?
All the time. That's right. I got through school on my credit effort point.
I will say teachers are at a political disadvantage, like a small p politics political advantage, because you're asking them to go home, and like all this money flows back to the school corporation. That's no different than you or me having to go petition our boss for more money, right? So there is a lot more political leverage if the state takes this up. I don't know if it's any better for teachers at the end of the day or not.
I don't know either. It reminds me a lot of like the property tax issue and even education funding, where when the state started taking over more and more, part of the problem is that teachers, you're talking about the $30,000 a year paid teacher. That's in some parts of the state. In other parts of the state, teachers are paid much better. And so developing a system that helps some teachers you wouldn't want a system where some teachers got paid lower amounts of money.
But the disparity,
even if you establish a floor, you're still going to end up with a lot of disparities in the system, which is why fixing it in a few months is just, it's not.
Okay, but 270 of the districts are paying that amount of money. Okay, the aberration, the exception to the rule are those that are well paid. Most of them are not.
Can I just say, I sent this effort scenario out there, and I just want to complete the thought. The reason I bring that up is that's why I think we're not seeing more outrage on the part of organized labor, teachers, and so forth. Yes, they're not satisfied with the numbers thus far, but they have seen bits and pieces of the puzzle come together. For instance, the Senate proposal actually keeps intact the teacher recognition grants that would have been eliminated under the governor's proposal, $30 million or so, and maybe distributes it in a way that has ensures that everybody gets a little bit more. So you throw that in there. You throw some of the new teacher incentive programs that are designed to get people into the field and to arm them with the skills they need early on in their careers. Maybe people see that gets back to the effort points. You see that this isn't going to be solved this session, but there is enough to keep people from getting placards and marching on the street.
And it doesn't sound like we're going to solve it in this discussion either, so we'll move along. South Bend Mayor and Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg and Vice President Mike Pence took issue with each other this week over questions of faith and homosexuality. Speaking at an LGBTQ Victory Fund event, Buttigieg argued Pence's opposition to homosexuality couldn't necessarily be supported by the Vice President's faith.
My marriage to Chasten has made me a better man. And yes, Mr. Vice President, it has moved me closer to God. I can tell you that if me being gay was a choice, it was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade. And that's the thing I wish the Mike Pences of the world would understand. That if you got a problem with who I am, your problem is not with me. Your quarrel, sir, is with my creator.
It did not take Pence long to respond.
Well, look, I worked very closely with Mayor Pete when I was governor of the state of Indiana. We had a great working relationship. And he said some things that are critical of my Christian faith and about me personally. And he knows better. My family and I have a view of marriage that's informed by our faith, and we stand by that.
Mike O'Brien, what should we make of this dispute?
That Mayor Pete is using Mike Pence to try to leverage you know, successful. Lift up to the national conversation.
I think, to
some degree, I'll agree that it's been successful. If you just look at the press he's gotten in the last week, I think what we saw during RFRA, and I think that's the model that Mayor Pete's looking at and identified here, that there is an undercurrent nationally of people who are focused on LGBT issues that are willing to be loud about it. And Mike Pence at the time was like the trigger and that activated that in RFRA in this issue that occurred at the Indiana State House. So I think he's trying to just find that undercurrent and use it to leverage a national image. I think he's doing it somewhat successfully. I think he is revising the relationship he had with Governor Pence back when they were in office. The governor did support a lot of the projects that Mayor Pete's now touting and were paid for by state government, including the one, the location where he's actually set to make his announcement on Sunday, which was paid for by Mike Pence's community investment dollars.
John Schwannis, were you surprised at all that the vice president kind of bet on this one and responded? I mean, among other things, Buttigieg is the mayor of the 301st largest city in America.
And that does pack quite a wallop. yes and no. Clearly he could have dodged the question altogether. I mean, it was an interview setting and someone did hit him with the question. So I suppose if he had not addressed it or said poo-pooed it completely, we might have criticized him for dodging a legitimate question. So he engaged. It was interesting. He framed it as the mayor's attack, to the extent it was an attack, as being on his faith and Christianity generally. I think what Mayor Pete would suggest is that it was more of an assessment of or a questioning of Mike Pence's interpretation of Christianity or of the faith. And there clearly is a distinction. One would alienate perhaps one person, the other would alienate hundreds of millions of people. So, including some in the 341st largest city in America. So, I'm not surprised. And we shouldn't be surprised that religion and faith questions are going to be part of the discussion from here on out, because that's unavoidable. You look at how national media, and not just media, but the zeitgeist has positioned Dan Quayle, whether it's Saturday Night Live or other, Dan Quayle, Mike Pence, so many Hoosiers who ascended these roles. That is, he's set up as sort of an antagonist or pro-antagonist, depending on your point of view, and will be used as such in the campaign.
I think it's interesting that this is being seen as some kind of fight. What it really is it represents two different viewpoints in this larger debate that's happening across our country. Whatever side that you're on, there are lots of people on both sides of this argument, and to me, I thought both of them were fairly civil about the whole thing, and really, I feel like that they're reflecting a larger conversation, and so it's just interesting to me that a lot has been made of it as if it's a problem, or as if this relationship is something other than what happens all across America on a regular basis as people try to discuss issues.
And is that why this got as big as it did?
Well, I frankly think it was Mike Pence appealing to his base by showing how tough he is on this issue. I mean, he's been on the wrong side of this issue his entire career, okay? And it isn't only about what you think about homosexuality, okay? It's also about authorizing discrimination against homosexuality, which is what RFRA did and what Mike Pence was for. And I think Pete Buttigieg has a responsibility, as we all do, to speak out against that type of discrimination, whatever your beliefs are. I mean, you may think that the sexes should not have any kind of relationship like that, and that's fine, if that's part of your religious belief. But that doesn't authorize you to treat them in a very discriminatory fashion, which is something Mike Pence stood for.
Okay, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: who is right about faith and homosexuality, Pete Buttigieg or Mike Pence? A, Buttigieg, B, Pence, C, neither. Last week's question is, Is the hate crimes bill signed into law a win for Indiana? 47% said yes, 40% said no, and 13% said it's too early to tell. If you would like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana lawmakers have deliberated on a measure that would move two Gary casinos inland. The Senate approved a bill to do so earlier this session, with the plan being to have one casino remain in Gary and the other move to near Terre Haute. This week, the House Ways and Means Committee amended the Senate bill to allow for the two casinos to remain in Gary and create another one near Terre Haute. This change created fresh discussion among some lawmakers about an expansion of gambling here in Indiana. Leslie Weidenbender, is this an expansion of gaming?
So I think we're long past talking about what's an expansion of gambling or not. Gambling is ubiquitous in Indiana. I do think there will be a question for folks in Terre Haute whether they would like to have a casino in Terre Haute. That is a local decision that was made across the state. But in general, gambling is pretty much everywhere now. I don't think it matters whether you move a few thousand slot machines from one place to another, whether you allow somebody to have table games versus not. Obviously, a change allowing gambling on sports is a big change, but that's happening all across the country. It's really a national change that happened with the courts, and it's just a matter of how it's regulated in Indiana.
John Schwantes, is this a sign that that we have moved to a new phase of Indiana history? Because it wasn't all that long ago that discussions about gaming and gambling would pretty much rip the state apart.
Oh, yeah. I think I've been around long enough to watch the metamorphosis of this debate. It used to be about one M. If we want to use the alphabet, it was about morality. The debates often would talk about we don't want, sound like Professor Harold Hill and the reaction to his, you know, launch of a pool hall in River City, and we don't want sin here, you know, we got trouble here in River City. And that was the notion that back in the early phases here of is this just going to corrupt youth or turn our workforce into a lazy group that can't maintain the job responsibilities? You don't hear that anymore. Now it's a different M. Now it's market share. And the questions are much more about what cities suffer as new facilities open, who has controls the market share from counties that are adjacent, for instance, to the border of the state of Indiana. You know, is there fairness in terms of the structure of the so-called racinos in Anderson and Shelbyville versus the other casinos in terms of the ability to have live humans at table games? I mean, it's a totally different discussion, and it's not unlike what we saw the same thing with alcohol sales in the state, where it used to be about corrupting the youth and the Bible says, and then it becomes reading data analyses about who's going to win and lose in terms of market share.
Ann Delaney, Mike O'Brien, are these debates going to be about gaming and gambling going to be much more procedural going forward and less divisive?
No, I think there's some big outstanding issues.
Are they about morality or are they about the kinds of things that John was talking about?
Well, they're about what John's talking about. The original question was this is an expansion of gaming. On live dealers and sports gaming, I think you can argue that looks a lot different in sports. You're creating more opportunities on sports betting, legalizing that for the first time in Indiana. I think the other piece of this, the company that came in and bought two existing licenses wanted to move them because the facilities that they bought were worthless. But that didn't look like an expansion. Now it kind of does. Now the state's basically eliminated one of those licenses and created a new one in Terre Haute. So I don't know. There's some big questions left to remain on transfer fees and what's the state's take in on all this. And we'll just see where that winds up.
And who benefits? I mean, the transfer fee has been dropped in half now. And the question.
Well, it started at zero, so I don't think.
They talked about $100 million.
But it was at
to zero, move from one.
There wasn't one when the bill started.
Oh, when the bill started, okay. The last iteration, before the current one was $100 million. And we're now bidding on the Terre Haute facility if the Terre Haute facility is built. Does that stay? Or are we back to who benefits and what political juice do the people have?
In terms of benefits, look at ownership. We haven't talked much about the provision. Yeah. Now, Spectacle Entertainment, which is the owner, as what you describe as these two worthless properties, that may be news to them. But under current law, they couldn't bid. If they kept both of those, they couldn't bid on the Terre Haute facility because there's a two-license cap. That would come out under a version of the bill as it's written, as it is right now, subject to change, which gets back to Spectacle being in a position that it could, if it wanted to loosen the purse strings, do whatever it wants to do in Gary and still
that limitation, that limitation has already become a joke. Because,
right.
I mean, Caesars owns two casinos and two
racetracks.
It gives Spectacle a willingness to do what it wants to do if it's willing to put money into it.
I think we should move along. Lawmakers made changes to a controversial payday lending bill this week, but it did not quiet the furor. The changes included lowering the maximum interest rate from 99% to 72%, capping the amount that could be borrowed, limiting the frequency with which loans could be made, and prohibiting lenders from seizing borrowers' property. Critics of the measure, some of them wearing T-shirts that say usury is evil, said the bill still exploits the poor. Proponents say it creates access to credit for people who need it and otherwise would not qualify. The bill moved out of the House Financial Institutions Committee on a 7-3 party line vote. John Schwanes, is it possible to bridge this gap?
It's tough because this may be more of a morality issue than the gaming and the alcohol sales used to be, because some people see it's just plain wrong to take advantage of people who don't have other banking services and other financial services to cash checks and to tie them over in certain circumstances. And they see any amount as usury as evil, whether it's 300%, 100%. So it's hard. Yeah, numbers, by adjusting the numbers and getting it to the middle ground, it is an attempt to bridge the gap. But I don't think you ever resolve the issue, because you will always have the stories of people who get caught in a very bad cycle, and you feel for them. I mean, it's a tough situation.
Leslie Weidenbender, do you see any further changes coming here, or anything that will make this less controversial?
No, absolutely not. And the truth is, what the legislature needs to start thinking about is the underlying causes of why people end up in these situations. I mean, right now we're dealing with a symptom of a much larger problem. It's part of the reason why I was excited to see that the Central Indiana Community Foundation this week announced that they were going to be working on inclusivity issues and poverty issues and really putting a lot of money and effort behind some of those kinds of things that will put people in a position where they don't need these kinds of loans. No, you're never going to be able to get rid of this kind of thing completely. I appreciate the folks that are trying to make it less onerous than it is now, and to try to help people get out of the cycle. The ability to get out of the cycle is really the most important thing.
It's really like the company store, except they're not selling anything. You know, you're indebted your entire life. 72% interest? Come on. That doesn't even count the origination fees and all the other things they build into these loans. It's unconscionable that we allow that. I mean, I routinely see used car sales at 28, 30, 36% interest. That's obscene. It really is. And they can get away with it under Indiana law.
Yeah, if you close the door, there's still obviously a huge market for this. The subprime lending industry in Indiana alone is $1 billion-plus industry. So the question for the legislature has always been, okay, well, where do these people go next? Because if they're going online and getting a 1,000% loan that's unregulated, completely unregulated, how do we fix that? If we close the door too tight and give people who can't walk into a bank and get a loan and have no cash, have no options, then where do they go?
These are desperate people,
and they
need help. We have to figure out a different system.
That's correct.
Okay, finally, a new kind of Indianapolis, a collection of five tiny houses just south of Lucas Oil Stadium, opened as a hotel. The rooms start at $75 a night, but go up for game days. Mike O'Brien, would you stay in a tiny house for a big game?
It's probably better than me driving home after a big game.
We won't pursue that.
It's a really cool company. Maggie Daniels, Mitch Daniels' daughter, started this tiny house kind of company in Indianapolis. It's really cool.
John Schwanes, is this a product of the fact that so much of the hospitality industry, we have so many different options now of places we can stay?
Well, it has changed dramatically. I mean, it's no longer the days that you go pick up your AAA or whatever, guidebook and pick which hotel you want. Now with Airbnb and the emergence of so many of the, it's the hospitality end of the gig economy, where instead of lending yourself out for an hour of work, you're finding a bed for a night, and that's why we're seeing so much effort and challenge on the part of legislatures to deal with it. Some do, can municipalities regulate? I mean, this is not the B&B model, but it does create all kinds of questions about what industry exactly is this and how do you regulate it.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Leslie Weidenbender of the Indianapolis Business Journal. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm John Kroll of Franklin College, thestatehousefile.com, and No Limits. Brandon Smith will be back next week. Join us then, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.